Good morning. It is good to see you this morning. We are so glad you're here. Guests, we're honored to have you, and we want to have you become a regular part of this church. And members, I encourage you to look around after the service, and if you see someone you don't recognize, go up and greet them, and it may be someone who's been here a while, and that's okay. You get to meet a new friend, and it may be someone who's new here. Either way, we want you to know that you are welcome here. We are in the second week of a new series, A Church on the Move, Church in a Changing World. And what you'll notice with this series each week is, along with the message that I'll give, one of the other leaders, usually one of the shepherds of our church, will come up and share a few minutes. And that's going to happen in just a moment. And then every Sunday also during this series, and we started this Sunday morning, this morning, we have all the adult classes combined in our Wortham Center, which is our middle building, and we had a great discussion with the elders sharing their perspectives. And so if you missed that, we've got that recorded, and you can ask me afterward. Kendall Grimes can send you a link to that, and that's a meaningful conversation, and every week it will follow a week behind the conversation that takes place. And so join us next week. We had a great crowd, a great conversation, and we invite you to come and be a part of that. At this time, I want to invite Craig Lair up to the front, and he's going to share for a few minutes before I get back up.
Good morning. So I spent this past week thinking about how I ended up here, and I've been here 24 years, and it's a little bit of an odd story, and I spent some time thinking about it. I had a cousin that was like a sister to me, and we both moved to Little Rock at about the same time. And she was looking for a church. She recently buried somebody with a different Protestant background, very entrenched in his belief. She came from a very entrenched belief system, and they were looking for somewhere they could go and worship together. And we were, at the time, looking around with them, and we visited and spent weeks and weeks and looked around, and we ended up here. And somehow, Danny Burleson, the minister at that time, connected with my cousin-in-law, because they both came from different backgrounds. Danny wasn't traditional background. In fact, he married into Church of Christ later. And so, oddly enough, we came because of them. 3, 6 months, maybe a year or two later, they moved. And so I've been here 24 years on the basis of somebody who was only here for a year. And so I got to thinking about how often does this happen and what information is out there. And I did a little bit of research, and I found these slides that go back over 6 generations. And what this information shows is the difference of recently wed Americans more likely marry outside the faith. And what they mean by that, and they have different categories of different Protestant groups or married completely different. And what you'll see as you look over 5 or 6 generations is a tremendous amount of change. 50 years ago, 1 out of 5 would be, or the other way to say it, 81% would marry within their own faith. Very close, didn't move around as much. They generally married at a pretty young age. And most of you can probably relate to that. They married both geographically to someone proximate to them, as well as in their religious background. That's changed over 5 decades. Now it's twice as likely. In fact, it's now 2 out of 5 that come from different religious backgrounds. And so what I've seen and noticed here is we have a lot of that. In fact, in my life group, over half of the couples in our life group have differing faith traditions of somehow. And they've come together in some way and ended up here. And so I've thought about what are kind of the implications. And the next slide is, when you think about it, is children. And this may be a little harder to see, but one of the things that stood out to me is a growing number of children come from either faith from only one parent, they have non-affiliated parents, or they have one that's religiously if connected and one that's not. And if you look down in the bottom, only about 1 out of every 3 children has two parents of the same faith these days. And so what does that mean? There's a lot of implications to that. You could go back to the other. But that a couple of things that it tells me is, you know, there has to be some focus on areas of agreement and where we can raise our kids. You know, we have to recognize the challenges that it creates for our families when I come from divergent backgrounds. And it made me think about the church here and the way that we've responded. You know, we've had some different views through the years. We've had a preacher came from a non, probably I've called it almost a non-religious background, in fact. We have a higher percentage than most that have an interfaith marriage. We have opened up our facilities, and Bert's mentioned this, to different groups that we may not personally be comfortable with, but that we provided a place to worship. And I've thought about some of the things that make this church special are actually things borrowed from other faiths: tenebrae, candlelight, baby dedication. Some of those are things that we borrowed from other traditions, but they've made this church special. And so I tried to think of what are the kind of future implications of this, because the statistics that I saw, it's changing even more so. People are moving, they're marrying later in life, they're getting married, and they're marrying people from across the country. And so what I thought about and what my hope is that we continue to be a welcoming church for those individuals, that we provide a place where people from various backgrounds are comfortable, that they can raise their children together. Their children have a place to grow and to learn Jesus. I thought of the concept of the family. You know, when you get married and you have this sort of shaking out process where you're deciding which parents you go to for all the holidays, and some of you newlyweds may remember that, but I can remember how that kind of shakes out at time. And church, we have an obligation as well to not just be the spouse in that marriage that says, we're going to do everything the way my family always does it, and then if we can fit any of your family traditions or holidays in, we'll work those around. That doesn't tend to work. Thought if that our hospitality becomes more and more important when we have this, because we want to not only support families to raise their kids, to teach them about Jesus, but we want to provide support for families. And we have several here that worship at multiple locations. And I think that's a great thing, that we want to support them and provide opportunities when they're here to build their faith, but also to be supportive of them in their own particular religious backgrounds. And I think finally, we want to be a place where everyone feels that the common issues and the common goods will come together to raise our kids.
Thank you, Craig. All right, I'm going to start out with something equally as scientific as what Craig just did, and that is, if you were to start a barbecue business, what would be the meat that you focused on the most? A random, weird, hypothetical question, right? But hang with me here. If you were to start a barbecue business, what would be the primary meat that you lean into? Now, there's a reason I ask that question. Because if you ask someone like me, who was born and raised in Texas, when we hear barbecue, we think beef. We think brisket. That is barbecue. But I'm even seeing some head nods like, oh my word, has the hypocrisy or has the problem started this early? If you ask someone from Arkansas, or I'm seeing Tennessee or other places in the deep south, when you talk about barbecue, what comes to mind for you? Pork. Pulled pork. Barbecue isn't brisket, barbecue isn't beef, barbecue is pork. We all know barbecue is pork, and yet we don't all know that barbecue is pork. It just depends, right? Or, what kind of sauce should you have? Should it be sweet or spicy or savory? Should it be a tomato base, or heaven forbid, a mustard based sauce? Which one is right? Which one is true? Which one is the real one? Well, is there a right or a real or a true on that? Kind of depends on how you grew up, and where you grew up, and the place you like to go, and how mama used to make it or grandma used to make it. It all falls under that category of barbecue, right? And yet it comes out pretty different sometimes. When Paige and I were in Italy a few years ago, we went to a train station, and there was a McDonald's, and it was a McDonald's, and it looked like a McDonald's, and yet it did not look like a McDonald's. It had some of the standard Mickey D's fare. I assume a Big Mac is a Big Mac is a Big Mac in America and Italy and wherever, although there may be some differences. But when we looked at this McDonald's, they had a pastry section that looked like this. I want a pastry section that looks like that. I don't think an Italian would know what to do with an American-styled fried pie from McDonald's. It's like, what is this creation? They've got their own pastries. It's still McDonald's. It's still the name. It's got the brand. It's a global brand. But what you get here and what you get there and what you get in some other places, there's differences. There's variations. I'm told that Russians cannot stand just plain Lay's potato chips. But if you have some artificial caviar flavor sprinkled onto those Lays, thank you, comrade, delicious. In China, when Oreos first hit the market, not many people were interested. And so they had to do some research. Why do people not like Oreos? We down the Oreos here. Well, they found out they were too sweet for the taste buds of people in China. And they were too big. I've never seen an Oreo and thought, you know, that thing is too big. But they thought, that thing is too big. And so they had to shrink it down and take away some of the sweetness. And then they started adding flavors like green tea and other fruit flavors. And to us, we say, thank you, but no thank you. And to them, the sales skyrocketed. Missionaries have known from the beginning, if you want to share Jesus and show Jesus in other countries, in other cultures, in other settings, in other traditions, with other tastes, you have to contextualize the gospel. And that's what Jesus does. Hebrews 2 reminds us that God intentionally, purposefully took on human flesh in a time, in a place, in a culture, in a tradition, so that he could meet people where they were, so that, the Hebrew writer says, he could be a better high priest. Because if you want to be a priest, you can't just stay back. You have to go to where the people are so that you can help connect them to where God is. Some of you know, some of you may not know. My brothers, both of my brothers and their families were missionaries in Brazil for more than a decade. And they went to share and show that God so loved the world that he gave his only son. And God did great work through their mission team. But here's what any missionary knows. If you're a missionary from America and you go to another country and culture, and you try to establish an American church with American traditions and American practices and preferences and structures, that effort will fall flat. You will meet no one. And it's not enough to just learn the language. That's just the start. You got to do the Jesus thing and put on the flesh of the people around you. You meet them where they are so that you can help them go to where God is. And that is exactly why Paul gives his most famous missionary statement in 1 Corinthians 9, That's where we're going to be this morning. You can open up your Bible. You'll see it on the screen behind me. 1 Corinthians 9, starting in verse 19. Though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. Now, let me stop there for a moment. Paul, if you've read through his letters, you know he fights legalism in almost every letter he writes. He will not preach, nor will he tolerate any approach to following Jesus that puts law and tradition above faith and love. And when you try to make faith first about rules, you actually ruin the faith. You abandon the faith. That's not faith anymore. It's more faith in yourself than faith in God. And so Paul says, it is for freedom that Christ has set you free. Which makes his statement all that much more interesting and ironic that he would say, it is for freedom that Christ has set you free. And now, in my freedom, this is what my faith compels me to do. I become a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. Jesus makes us free in order to live more deeply, but also in order to serve more deeply. We serve better, we love better from a place of freedom than a place of legalism. And so that's why Paul, in his freedom, chooses servitude to everyone. Let's keep going. Verse 20. To the Jews, I become like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I become like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. Let's stop again. Just a reminder, Paul happens to be a Jew. And not only was Paul a Jew, he was, by his own description, at the top of the class. He was zealous in his obedience to the law and in his proclamation of the law, which shows you how truly free Paul knows he is in Christ. That he says to the Jew and those under the law, I become like a Jew and those under the law. When he serves in the name of the gospel, and when he shares in the name of the gospel in other towns, Paul goes to various Jewish synagogues to share the good news. And when he is there, he willingly puts himself back in the place of following the law, even though he knows he's free from it. He'll follow the dietary kosher laws. He'll follow the Sabbath laws, all while advocating for freedom. If that will help him win some who are still connected to the law. But, verse 21, to those not having the law, which happens to be most of us in here, Gentiles, I become like one not having the law. Lo, I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. In other words, he's not saying to the thief, I become a thief, and to the alcoholic, I become an alcoholic. Paul will follow God's moral laws. He says, I'm not under the law, but I'm not lawless either, you understand. But it's a moral law that I am bound to. But he says, I won't be bound by traditions, even if it makes other people within the church who do feel bound by tradition nervous and upset. And if you've read your New Testament, you see it a lot. It makes others nervous and upset. But he's not going to be bound by those traditions, especially if it means connecting other people to Christ. So if a Gentile invites Paul to a pulled pork barbecue
on a Saturday. He says, when and where? I'll be there and I'll eat up. I'll participate. Which would have been a no-no in his past. But now, it's a yes for the sake of the gospel. If it helps win some, if it helps me connect with them, I'm all in. Pass the bacon, hand me a pulled pork sandwich, I'm ready to eat. To the weak, I become weak. To win the weak. Now notice he doesn't balance this one like he does with the other. He doesn't say, and to the strong, I become like the strong, because in the Corinthian church, he's fighting a lot of people who think they're really strong, who think they're really wise, and who are using that position of their wisdom and strength to run roughshod over people. But if you find yourself in a place of vulnerability, weakness as an outsider, Paul will come beside you every day of the week. I will humble myself. I'm not going to lift myself above others, but I'll lower myself to the lowest possible point if that helps me win some. And he concludes with this: I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. I've only been a part of buying one new car in my life. I bought a variety of cars that are new to me. My first car I purchased was 10 years old when I got it, and it was a 1982 Honda Prelude. Just feast your eyes on that beautiful machine behind me. That bad boy went from 0 to 60, maybe, with the wind at my back while I was going down a very steep hill. But I loved that car because that was my first car. But I've only been a part of purchasing one new car in my life, and that was Paige and I purchased together about 10 years ago a Nissan Versa that she drove. And some of you saw that car. We had it for about 8 years. And there is something that those who purchase a new car, or if you hop in a vehicle of a friend who just purchased something new, there is something that people associate with new cars as much or more than anything else, and people love it. Do you know what it is? That new car smell. What is it about that new car smell? Is it the actual smell, or is it what we associate with it? The excitement, that experience of having something new. I don't know what it is, but here's what I do know. Enough people are drawn to that, have a positive association with that, that car companies work that into their advertisements. And enough people crave that and love that, that there are dozens of products on the market, sprays and plug-ins and those rear view mirror hangy down things that are all suggesting that they can manufacture for you that new car smell. And having that experience and that bias, I love that smell. It made a story that I read within the last year or so especially stand out to me. It was a story about a patent application by the Ford Motor Company. Ford filed a patent regarding that famous new car smell, and you may be thinking, Ford, you can't patent that new car smell. That is an outrage, and that is, in fact, the opposite of what they did, or at least they're trying to patent. What Ford is trying to patent is an odor removal process that seeks to eliminate the new car smell after a vehicle has been purchased. And here's why. Because Ford is trying to expand into the fastest growing market
in the world for vehicles, and it's not in the good old US of A. It's in China. And after I spent a couple of minutes talking about new car smell, you can guess what the number one complaint among Chinese car buyers is when they purchase a new car. It is that new car smell. They can't stand it. That ranks more than double, it shows up more than double the number of other complaints concerning new cars. It shows up as the top reason for not buying a new car. So Ford and other car makers have a choice. If they want to be a global brand, which is what it takes to stay alive and thrive in the car industry, they have to ask questions like, just because people have historically been attracted to the new car smell in places like America, if they are repelled by it in other places like China, can we make modifications to meet consumers where they are and still be true to who we are? In other words, are we in the business of new car smells, or are we in the business of new car sales? And if the smells, as much as we may love it in our culture, gets in the way of the sales, which is ultimately what the business is all about, are they going to be open to remove the barriers that impede their fundamental business? So here's the question we're trying to ask. Do we remember as a church what business we're in? Do we remember as a church what business we're in? We are here to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love our neighbors as ourselves. And part of that love to God and neighbor means we try to win as many people as possible. And to do that, we have to start thinking like missionaries again. And we have to keep thinking like missionaries, because what works in one place doesn't always work in another. What works for one person doesn't always work for another. What works in Stuttgart may not work in West Little Rock. And what works in West Little Rock may not work in another place in West Little Rock or anywhere else in Little Rock. What worked in 1979 didn't work as well in 1999. May not work as well in 2019. In every new time and in every new culture, every new context, we have to be driven by the heart and the spirit that Paul conveys in this passage. We become all things to all people so that by all possible means we might save some. The message we share remains constant, but the means by which we share changes to meet people where they are. Love of God and love of neighbor compels us to always stay true to God's kingdom and God's ways. But love of God and love of neighbor also compels us to at least be willing to discuss when we should sacrifice some of our customs and comforts, when it helps us connect our neighbors with God, and when it helps us remove barriers that get in the way of their seeing God. The message doesn't change, but the messengers have to continually swallow our pride and lay aside our rights and re-examine our preferences And as Paul says, even give up freedoms so that we can serve, so that we can help those who don't know the freedom that only God can bring, so that they can know, so that as a church, we can win as many as possible.